Weeks away, the PhD cast is back. Joining podcast regulars this week is Chris Padmore, head of Airwave, to talk all things mobile. We're covering Android overtaking Apple, where this is the year of mobile, as well as Google's new music streaming service and YouTube now going subscription. And is Adlan struggling with work-life balance? BNT report would suggest it is. This is the PhD cast from Australia. So joining me on the PhD cast this week are PhD cast regulars Stuart Gurney.
Hello everyone.
And Nicola Davey.
Hello.
And also joining us, a very special guest. We're very pleased and slightly honoured to have Chris Padmore here. He's the head of Airwave.
Hello.
Welcome to the PhD cast.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Very good to have you here. So kicking off this week, news that in tablets, Android has overtaken Apple in terms of shipment numbers. Is that right?
Yeah, very exciting news.
So, talk us through it.
So Android's now overtaken Apple as the most owned operating system in terms of the tablet. In the tablet space, that's global trends. Obviously, in Australia, it's a bit different to that. Apple is much larger in Australia compared to Android. We actually saw Android on the smartphone side overtake Apple last year, so it's interesting now that Android's now overtaking Apple in the tablet space as well. So probably set to see that trend continue.
Why? That's the question.
Well, I suppose the obvious one is just the number of tablets that Android will run on. So Apple's obviously only on the Apple tablet, but obviously Android can go across, you know, lots of devices, Samsungs and HTCs and all the rest of it.
I'm still such a, I know it's awful, there's no such thing as loyalty as we know, but I'm an Apple loyalist, arguably, because I just always would always buy an iPad or a...
They just work easy, don't they?
They just feel more intuitive, and that's completely from having never experienced Android operating system.
So I recently left the Apple Fold, and I've now got a Nexus, which is the LG Google phone, and it is awesome.
It talks to you, though, doesn't it? And it welcome you back each day.
Well, it can talk to you. It's got Google voice recognition software in there.
Siri
which is
talks
really
to
good.
Me.
Yeah, but Siri gets confused sometimes, right?
Don't we
especially
all?
Especially when she talks to you. it's 2013. Is this finally the year of mobile, Chris?
We've had the year of mobile.
Have we? When was it? Did I miss it?
It was last year. There's the stars.
Breaking news, everyone.
It's the decade of mobile. There's
It's
the decade, yeah. There's been people have got really high expectations of mobile, so I don't think it'll ever happen in like a bang moment. It'll just kind of gradually increase over time. So I think the IAB had that spend figures were up sort of 200% year on year, so we've definitely seen the trends going the right way in terms of advertisers finally getting to invest in the medium. But the audiences have been there for a few years now.
So you guys, the year of mobile has been coming for a while. When you hear year of mobile, what's your take on that? What do you think it means from a planning or media perspective? What does it actually mean?
I guess from my point of view, it means that advertiser demand exists, and I think there's still a lack of that. So part of that will come from not being really aware of how to use mobile. But part of that also is a bigger marketing construct of where mobile fits and things. Because it's, I mean, we were having this debate yesterday around kind of the role for mobile FMCG. So you can see non-FMCG and durable brands, mobile becoming about utility and becoming about service, which is brilliant. But for more FMCG, arguably entertainment-focused, content-driven brands, mobile is still a bit of a grey area. Because all you're potentially doing is adding incremental reach or adding to existing campaigns. So it still feels supplementary versus having a really clear role. I guess for me, there's still a lot of barriers to usage, I'd argue.
Yeah, definitely. I think it will get to a stage where it feels like it's really kicked off when brands are requesting it and they're not taking much convincing that it's the right place for them to be putting their ad dollars, I suppose. But one of the biggest challenges is the creative agencies haven't really picked up the baton and run with it. So if they did more, if they were more comfortable in the space, then they'd be recommending it more to their clients, who would kind of, rather than it coming from the publishers and the media buying agencies.
Mm. My question around how ubiquitous mobile spend and usage will be, I think comes down to the infrastructure, because I still wonder whether one of the biggest barriers actually is people not sure, like users, mobile users, just not sure how much it's going to cost them if they click and stream this stuff. And a lot of stuff is getting streamed, and we're seeing a lot of the carriers now trying to make it more transparent in terms of how their data usage is getting used up and stuff. So before we even get to what role advertisers and brands and everything has, my focus still is on actually what do people think about when they engage with any type of content, and is there still a fear factor of if I click on this thing and it goes through, is it going to use up all my data?
Especially in this market when you don't have the data bundles that some other markets have.
It's less of an issue in the UK where they kind of all roll it in, but I can see how that is an issue. But they're starting to see trends now that the telcos have got to be careful, because they're actually seeing more messages being communicated via like WhatsApp and those type of messages than text messages, and so the amount of money that they're going to make out of voice will flatline or decline, and it will be data play. So they'll be just become data providers, and actually they'll be selling data packs together, as opposed to
the NBN over the next 10 years. That's why it's so important, because the infrastructure at the moment wouldn't be able to withstand the demand and the volume of people wanting to use those networks. So I think that before we even have the creative challenge and the targeting challenge of mobile, I do think that it remains an infrastructural challenge.
But people get data packs now, don't they? Do you think?
Oh yeah, they do. I mean, but you burn through it so quickly.
Yeah.
I think you burn through it.
All my sneaky Snapchats of we're saying.
And but we also, I mean, I've got an issue per se. With the idea of advertising on mobile, I kind of think there's an assumption that because we can now have mobiles and things that we take the advertising concept and now we just do it on mobile. I think years ago, in some of my early years in Sydney, I had someone at a conference, and I don't remember who it was, they said that in a TV, in a broadcast space, you've got viewers. When online came along, people became browsers. When people have a mobile, they hunt us. And ad works really well when you're planning for viewers. They were to a certain extent when you're planning for browsers. But if we're planning for hunters, which is the mode that we're in on a mobile phone, should ads even be the default way, the default tool that we use to engage people?
Well, I guess it depends what you're doing on a mobile phone.
Exactly. So, but
I'm not always hunting on a mobile
I don't think
phone.
You always...
I'm sometimes browsing.
I think things have changed. I think people's behaviour has moved on. Again, as infrastructure has become more accessible and I can use my mobile device as I might have done my online experience.
Yeah,
probably people are just as much browsing as they are hunting out things. But where it does become really huntable is when you're in that geolocation. You've got the benefit of being able to have, I can go and find something and have a much more optimized hunt, if you like, because of my mobile is have a greater utility than a desktop online experience.
And I don't think usage is going one way or the other. It's not like it's all app-based or all browser-based. It's pretty evenly split here, depending on which age group you're looking at or which type of activity. Yeah. So I don't think you can categorise them into just hunting or whatever.
And we are seeing some really innovative and interesting uses of mobiles and tablets. So news.com.au reporting that there's now a book you can only read if you're sat at the desk where the writer created it. So the idea behind The Silent History, a global project that its creator Eli Horowitz describes as a novel that takes the form as an app. Chris, tell us about this.
You've kind of explained it there, really. There's an app where you read this book, and it's actually, there's only certain chapters of it that are activated if you're within a certain region or a certain area. So with great work, think of it like a walking tour in effect, but imagine it was for like a murder mystery, but you have to go to areas within Sydney that actually are relative to the story, which could then give you a perspective that you're reading the book that actually if you look around you can see the cafe where the murder was or whatever it might be. So it's kind of adding another layer of it, taking the real world, fusing it with the written word.
It's an incredibly immersive way of storytelling.
Yeah.
I think going back to the FMCG thing, it's a great idea, but I would just be mindful of the barriers to usage, and you said it's immersive, which by consequence involves depth and involves a lot of work to get to that stuff. And I think there is an inherent challenge in mobile in terms of how much you're asking people to do with some things like this. So from an FMCG point of view, great idea. You can imagine a creative agency coming up and talking about it, but then you've got to go and have the lens of, is it really worth it? Because I'm just a chocolate bar.
Yeah, from a brand perspective, it's almost like a treasure hunt thing, isn't it? But then they're really quite hard to get lots of people doing those types of things because the level of commitment you have to go and do to it, I suppose.
But I guess as a distribution point, it becomes really interesting.
But it makes it interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's the whole... we've looked at what world of publishing, what is publishing going to look like in the digitised world, and we've seen what's happened to music, we've seen what's happened to films, and so I think that when I first read that I was a bit like, oh, that's bloody pointless, because you think about how brands might try and use it and you kind of think, oh my god, it's too hard basket, quote Annalisa Pardini, that's her expression, it's too hard basket to go and expect people to go and want to interact with my brand story about this. However, think about it as a distribution of, for publishing, amazing way of being able to bring books to life and create more experiences and immersive things. I would totally want to do that with the whole Sherlock Holmes stuff and go around.
A Sydney tour around the
world. And so for the right type of content, but I would be really hesitant of any old brands for FMCG picking up this and kind of going, brilliant.
I think actually that's a big problem with mobile, because it's such a creative and diverse platform. I think there's some big thoughts and they also get shoehorned in lots of different directions. I don't think there's a filter yet, just because it's fairly new, of creative agencies or media agencies being really clear as to the role and the thing they should and shouldn't do. Because I mean, you can't move for presentations for it. And here's the solution, it's an app.
Yeah.
And it's usually really highly immersive.
You literally can't move.
You can't move for apps, literally. I'm pinned against the wall by apps on a daily basis. I know. And I just think that that's because there's no self-filtering, and that only confuses marketers, and it almost, we're making a broad for our own back in some respects, because we're not being true to the behaviour and the consumer experience and the consumer wants and needs that should be driving the ideas first and foremost.
Cool. On to other news. Google has unveiled a music streaming service. They've launched a new subscription service overnight, actually, called Google Play Music All Areas. This is a report from B&T. Google's engineering director, Chris Yerger, confirmed the new service at the Google's I/O annual developer conference, confirming it would be enabling users to stream music from a vast library onto any device using, of course, Android. He told the audience, "This is radio without rules. It's as lean back as you want to, or as interactive as you want to." The deal covers Warner Music, Universal, and Sony, so a huge library, and currently priced at $9.99 US cents, with pricing for Australia and New Zealand to be rolled out soon. Google entering music streaming.
It makes perfect sense, continuing the mobile conversation we've just had with the proliferation of Android, meaning that we can then access music on the go in ways that other service providers don't allow us. So Spotify do have a mobile proposition, which is awesome, but I can just imagine the functionality of this service being so much more tailored to the Android capabilities, which will just mean it becomes really popular.
And you're playing to an increasing base of Android users who are comfortable with Android and who are increasingly using Google across multiple touch points in that as well. So this can only increase Android and Google's play in this area, right?
Yeah, definitely. And even more so as more devices start talking to each other, and that becomes really interesting. So if you say you get Google TV and you know how far down the track that is, and that'd be kind of really interesting to see how they can talk to each other, sync each other, and work together, I suppose. I don't know, I'm a Spotify man, so I'm not sure how this will play out for me personally. But
adoption of Spotify outside of people that work in
media,
marketing and media,
yeah, we've got really
is actually
view.
Really low. So I just wonder what people are finding the barrier of using Spotify, and if it's this whole streaming thing again, and therefore is there, what's the value proposition from the Google Play that we think could overcome some of the barriers from Spotify outside of the marketing and media
paternity? They're both subscription services, aren't they? Google one and Spotify.
I think that's a really interesting point, and I think
Thanks, Jim.
I think for Spotify point of view, a lot of people work in the UK and it's bigger, Google One Point, so we're bringing that precedent into this market. I think the familiarity, I mean, we've seen in previous conversations about how this market is particularly good at piracy, and so downloading music is just as easy and just as prevalent as streaming it. So I think that's a big barrier, because people already have extensive libraries, don't need a radio service because they can access it via Genius on iTunes or whatever that system is. So I don't know if there's the same need for a streaming service. And I think for me on the Google Play one, the key thing is price. So in this market, we're still the barrier of all the ridiculous costs that we have to pay for such things and rights for music and films. So,
and it's $12.99 Spotify at the moment, isn't it?
So depending on that price point that Play come back with, I think that would be a big barrier to usage.
There are ones that are free, like Pandora's free, isn't it? But it's just less customisable. You just listen to radio stations as opposed to specific tracks.
I mean, Spotify is free, but I mean, the barriers of Spotify as well would be that there are some tracks that aren't on it. It will be about how proliferant the content is and how much it costs. So the value equation, as you said.
But what's been interesting for me is how it's almost kind of come full, well, to a certain extent, full circle. But people, I mean, I've just stopped buying music. I do not buy music anymore. I've got
Spotify.
Yeah, I have Spotify Premium, and I haven't bought Tote Spot Supremes, and I haven't bought music in months. And if that becomes a mainstream behaviour, then the music studios, they really, really are going to need these deals. It's going to become their primary source of revenue.
Yeah, well, that's what, I mean, we talked about this before, about the shift to live music and concerts being a bigger play, because they know that the long tail of this income stream is eroding significantly. But I think artists get like 0.0.0.1 of a cent every time a Spotify track is played. So that's just not enough margin, I'd imagine, to drive enough incremental revenue for artists.
Well, but you're relying on scalability once you've got a million people doing that.
But then you factor that in the long tail.
Yeah, if you're on the long tail of music, then you've got like seven people. Yeah. But then again, that was probably always the case. If you were a niche artist, you probably only had seven people buying your album in the first place. But what's interesting as well is the cascade into other media. I was just thinking about Glee and the extent to which as soon as a song or music is on Glee, downloads or streams for that go through the roof, but also things like
The Voice,
X Factor. So it's almost like music is becoming much more codependent on other kinds of media and other kinds of entertainment content as well.
I mean, the Voice model is awesome, isn't it? As soon as they even do a cover of a song, it's on iTunes that moment, and then there's a call to action it on TV today.
And revenue generated by the likes of iTunes and Spotify has overtaken the radio royalties that you get. So it's definitely kind of going down that way.
So what's that again?
The revenue generated by the likes of iTunes and Spotify have overtaken radio royalties for the first time in music history.
Wow!
So earlier this year.
Wow.
Heard it here.
Heard it here first. Okay. You didn't, but you know, you heard it here. And also from Google, YouTube has unveiled a subscription channel service. It's unveiled 30 paid channels, which sees 30 initial launch partners charge viewers a monthly fee to watch content on YouTube, signalling a new revenue stream for the platform and its content producers. This is a huge step for YouTube, essentially behaving almost like a kind of a on-demand cable channel on online, right?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a brilliant step for them. And the biggest issue with YouTube has always been it's a massive content aggregator, but never a filterer. So for me, it feels like a subscription service starts to help to prioritize content. So some of it's worth paying for, some of it's not. So actually start to help consumers navigate through that sea of people, cats playing on.
I agree and disagree. I agree with the helping people facilitate better filtering. I disagree with the paid for model, because I think that goes against a hell of a lot about what Google as a brand has always stood for and represented, and that it's always amazing, best kind of utility with that is there for everyone. So I think that, well, I think that the filtering and being able to personalise and have access to the best type of content quickly, but I don't agree with the subscription model for that. Going to exactly all the same points that you mentioned earlier. Because will YouTubers that have been using YouTube for, you know, what, how long? 15 plus years? Are they going to now want to switch their perception of going, this stuff I've always got free, now there's a reason to pay for it? But when you've got other services like Hulu and stuff that's coming in from an international that have already kind of set the bar of paying for stuff.
But wouldn't it be stuff that you weren't getting free before, like Game of Thrones episode that you'd have to buy through Foxtel or something?
Again, I think people who are on YouTube would find a way of getting that get that for free anyway. So I don't think it does YouTube as a brand any favours becoming paid for.
So you won't be subscribing anytime soon then, Nick?
No, I'm just going to go to Stu's house and watch his subscription.
Which I've obviously claimed back.
But it gets very interesting. I mean, we often do our Game of Thrones on the PhD cast. When I say often, I mean it's the second time we've done it. But you can imagine HBO kind of hosting some kind of Game of Thrones channel that you subscribe to, places buying the DVDs and all of that, or iTunes, extra content. You can imagine really content properties that have got a hugely loyal following could be a really interesting revenue stream to aggregate all that content in one paid channel.
But then the danger is that model we're now starting to move towards, so aggregation within one channel of that content actually isn't the best for HBO or those type of publishers, simply because we've spoken about how diversification of that content is it's what's needed to keep revenue.
Well, I don't think it would replace it, but I think it's a potentially very potent additional revenue stream, an additional way to access content like that.
Well, make it optional then. I mean, just I think it was
where you can pay if you want.
Pay what you want. But who was it? Was it Portishead?
Radiohead.
Radiohead. That did that
in Rainbow.
Yeah. And so maybe if there was a, for the people who are YouTube users, which we know they are, this is massive. We're not talking about a niche online site and niche audiences. If the publishers, HBO, made it available to say, right, while you're within this platform that you're comfortable with using, you can get access to this in real time, but you've got to pay for it, make that an option as opposed to a rule.
I think it just depends on the content.
Yeah. There would be things that you'd be more willing to pay for, but I think that why would the head music have gone the way it has done?
We still subscribe to Spotify, we just spoke
we
about
do.
It.
We do. But
I don't actually. I just get the free version on the desktop side. But anyway.
Finally this week, a poll by, again, B&T has revealed that Adnan seems to be struggling with work-life balance. The poll has found that nearly half of respondents in a survey believe their agency does not care about work-life balance. 500 people responded to the question, does your agency do enough to encourage its staff to maintain a work-life balance? 41% of respondents said their agency does not care about work-life balance. Its only concern is getting work done no matter what the hours. In response, Peter Hawken, who's the CEO at OMD, pointed out that pressure on agencies is acute and getting worse. He said, this effect means the predatory new business policy is a norm for many agencies. We're encouraging unsustainable pricing models within our industry. Simon Ryan, who's MD over at Cara, described the poll results as appalling. And our very own managing director here, Toby Hack, went further. He said he was stunned by the poll findings. Are we stunned by the fact that 41% of people think that there isn't a work-life balance in Adland?
Not really.
Yeah,
I think
not
really. It's kind of
not really.
People are used to people in agencies spending longer working than they are on the publisher side. I don't know how much that's got to, I suppose that has got to do with the company they work for, but it's also the individual's kind of desire to make sure they're doing the best job, and they're probably more likely to spend longer hours there or feel closer or more committed to the agency, say, that you would do if you're on the publisher side. I think you feel a bit more loyal, I suppose.
I think it is interesting that advertising media and comms generally, it's almost a creative industry, but there's a lot of industry within it, and that creates a bit of a, I suppose, quite a potent combination that you've got to invest time in being creative. But there's also a lot of physical way to get out the door as well. It's probably an industry that's ripe for requiring a lot of time to do it well.
Yeah, I agree. I have 3 points on this. First one, I think I agree with Hobbs's point around the predatory nature that we have to operate in the current climate. So we just have to work harder. Mm. That's the nature of stuff. Margins are smaller. We're just going to have to work harder for the small amount of money. And that's just the nature of the media land, not necessarily ad land, but definitely media land. The other real point I wanted to make, interestingly, I think that I've seen stats year on year, and the actual working hours are on a level have actually been decreasing. But what is interesting is that they've become more vocal about things like this, so HR policies, and be more forthright about what we deserve. So the individualism that have come from this element, and that's just a generational thing.
So there's Gen Y is again.
It is basically Gen Y. So I think there's a lot of that within that. I mean, I've personally never worked. I worked massive hours when I was working in the UK and in another market. I find here is a much more acknowledged work.
You're barely here.
I'm barely here, I know. I'm here, not here at the moment. there's definitely a more acknowledged work life balance in this market.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the States. I mean, they work weekends, ridiculous hours. It becomes
as a norm.
As a norm.
Yeah, and I agree. My perception is that in Australia, I don't think it's as bad. I mean, might just be my experience of being here. But it certainly isn't as bad as it was in the UK, where I would very regularly work 2 or 3 evenings a week and weekends.
Yeah, so,
and I think that for me, again, personally, I would rather take the rough for the smooth and deal with the times when I need to put the extra hours in and take that Friday lunch when I can, because I enjoy working in the industry, and it's, I could be probably working as longer hours in an industry that I was personally was less passionate about. So for me, then, yeah, I don't mind doing it.
On which note, we'll call it a day. So a big thank you to Nicola, Rough with the Smooth Davey.
Woo! I'm going on lunch now, yay!
And a big thank you to Stuart Kearney.
I'm going back to my desk.
No, you're not. And a big thank you to our guest today, Chris Padmore. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
That was the PhD cast, and we will be back next week.
Bye!
I'm starving.